The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. The FA Cup final, a glorious victory for City, or the final nail in the coffin of modern football. Watford crumble after a bright start while Sterling, Jesus, De Bruyne and the Silvers tear them apart. Off the pitch, Vincent Kompany announces he's leaving and going to Belgium, while Pep doesn't like being asked some tricky questions about how he's paid. Elsewhere, Lyon's women continue their European domination. In Spain, Real lose again. Where next for Gareth Bale? There's joy for Kilmarnock in Scotland, a terrible Panenka in the A-League Grand Final in Australia, and Phil Jones has dyed his hair grey. We'll do all that, answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Spotkick asks, with nothing left to play for this season, shouldn't Football Weekly have used its fringe players this week? Nothing. We are sticking with our first team squad. People who were sent out to rot in the reserves can stay there. It is an A-list panel again. John Bruin, how are you?
I'm fine, Max.
Nice to see you.
Lovely to see you.
Hey, Mark Langdon from The Racing Post, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, Max.
Excellent news. Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
Did you miss me?
Not really. No. You seem to be having a very good time in Hong Kong, and Ellis is more than capable of standing.
Yeah, well, Colm says, how did the couple's retreat go for you last week? Max Ellis painted a lovely picture of the events you had planned. My one-man mission to eliminate deodorant from the world is going tremendously well. And then I popped over to Hong Kong, but I want to talk about John Moss in a bit, because that was the best bit of it. Let's start with the FA Cup final then. Manchester City 6, Watford 0, the joint biggest win in an FA Cup final to go with Bury's 6-0 demolition over Derby County, the day football died in 1903. Before we analyse whether this is the end of football or not, Mark, the game itself, Watford did actually go for it, didn't they? And they had that chance from Pereira, and then there was that possible penalty, and that could maybe have made a difference.
I think if you're massive outsiders like Watford were, you need those things to go for you. The Pereira chance was a really big one, and you know, if you get 1-0 up, there is something to defend and hold on to. And even if Man City score a couple of goals, you're still in it for, you know, a large part of that game. The handball incident, I mean, I would never give that as handball, but we have seen similar-ish ones in the Champions League sort of be given, and the Watford players were incensed. Again, you need that to go for you, I think, when you're Watford playing against Manchester City. And then the fact that Watford could have settled for maybe a 2 or 3 nil defeat and just put everybody behind the ball, but they did try to play a very high line. They became dispirited, and City were utterly ruthless towards them. And we always, when two big teams are in the FA Cup final, everybody's looking for a story. Why can't we have an underdog there? And then when they get there, everybody moans when it's a one-sided fixture.
John, did you enjoy it, or at what point did you stop enjoying it?
Just looking at the 26 minutes in, when David Silva scored that goal, a goal conceded after... Now, Watford, I thought, were known for being quite good in central defence and being good in the air. But when you allow, Mark described just before, as a session of head tennis between Raheem Sterling, David Silva, you know it's not going to happen for you. And at that point, you know, there'd already been I would say Pereira probably should have done better with Edison, but and the handball that Mark mentioned as well. At that point, you just thought, yeah, okay, I know which way this is going. Mark called it one-sided. It's the most one-sided. I mean, it is the most one-sided FA Cup final in living memory, of course. And it's probably... Manchester City fans won't like this. Manchester City fans probably won't like a lot of what is going to be said here, but it was probably the worst FA Cup final I've seen, just for its lack of spectacle. You can talk about Manchester City being good, but there was just that crashing sense of this is really not good to see.
Yeah, I agree. I really love the FA Cup final, and you know, when I was a kid, still harbouring notions of someday being a professional footballer, I dreamt that was the thing you wanted to win, you know, and watching the FA Cup final was an all-day spectacle. You know, started about 10 in the morning and you'd have reporters on the team coaches, helicopters monitoring the team coaches' progress to Wembley, interviews with the players. You know, there was always one player who was injured or suspended who'd be going down the coach doing the player profiles and the banter correspondent, you know, introducing teammates and the backstories. And it was just a real occasion. And this was anything but. I felt sorry for Watford. I think they did their absolute best and they just got absolutely steamrollered. Few of their players didn't deliver, you know, the selection of Gomez and goals was some criticised it for being overly sentimental. He didn't have a great game, but he was also ruthlessly exposed on occasion. Pereira was very indecisive throughout. Troy Deeney, who you'd expect to be influential, barely got a kick. And yeah, it was as FA Cup finals go, the only one I can remember being worse was one between Manchester United and Chelsea. I think that was eventually settled in added time by Didier Drogba. Barry,
yeah. I thought you meant last year's Barry. That wasn't a classic either.
Well, I was going to say, actually, Barry talked about the TV build-up. Where was the TV build-up? Because, you know, like Barry, I recall, you know, Satan Greavesy larking around, Michael Barrymore doing his often questionable turns. and, you know, clips from all through the season and, you know, just it being a fun event. It wasn't necessarily good TV, but it was nice that it was there. But I noticed that BT Sport, they had only an hour's build-up. And what they had a TV programme on before called FA Cup Final Classics, and they had last season's final on, which was, as Mark said, almost as bad as the 2007 final. And then even the BBC studio was small. I noticed this sort of like pokey little room with Shearer, Wrighty and Gary Lineker in there, and just, you know, they were reduced to sort of banter between them because it was almost as if, well, we know what's going to happen here.
So I am very loath to say, you know, has the FA Cup lost its magic? I mean, it just depends. It depends what team you are, right? That was magic for Watford until the 26th minute. This FA Cup has been magic for them. It's been magic for Newport. It's been magic for smaller teams. Wolves did well, didn't they? They've all had moments. I think it just feels so deflating. That game felt so deflating. And it's interesting that so much now has been written about Manchester City and who owns them and the investigations into that. Is that only because it was 6-0? I mean, we've known.
Well, the thing is, City so far this season in 61 games in all competition have recorded 3-5-0s, 3-6-0s, 2-6-1s, 2-7-0s and a 9-0. You know, that's 11 games out of 61 in which they've won by 5 goals or more. It's slightly dispiriting, you know.
We weren't questioning it during the title race because that was interesting, right?
But I suppose there was the question that you were saying that these two teams are far better than everybody else. Now, you can talk about teams like Chelsea, Manchester United and Arsenal who have good resources and have actually wasted them. But the thing is, I think one of the best things about the title race is that we were talking about plucky little Liverpool against Manchester City. Liverpool were having their best season ever in the Premier League and still couldn't get past this Manchester City team.
I mean, I was just looking at players that didn't play for Manchester City on Saturday and that could make up a sort of reserve team. You've got Bravo in goal, who played for Barcelona, has won Copa Americas. Danilo, Stones, Otamendi and Mendy across the back four. Fernandinho and Delph in midfield with Foden, De Bruyne and Sane behind Aguero. That is,
they'd win the league, wouldn't they?
They probably would, and that you know, it is going to be difficult for anybody. I know Company has departed, and Fernandinho is getting on, but I mean that's going to be it's almost sort of soul destroying, I think, for everybody else. Thinking, well, how on earth do we get to that level as long as Pep Guardiola's there? I think when Guardiola leaves, maybe there'll be a drop in hunger because that's. When winners carry on winning, they need to find that hunger from somewhere, and it usually comes from the manager, and maybe there'll be a drop in standards when Guardiola leaves, and he won't be there forever. I just feel like the next couple of years, we may have to get used to this.
So should we, how much should we pray? I mean, this is the first time a men's team have won the domestic treble, right?
Yeah.
That is impressive.
Yes, yeah.
But it was also kind of inevitable. when
it was inevitable once they won on penalties against Chelsea in the League Cup final. I mean, it was, the possibility was very, very high at that point. And so, I mean, actually, talk about, you know, next season. I mean, Pep even did that little show of how much hunger he has with the Raheem Sterling, you know, where he's telling him off about what move he should do. And I mean, there is this cult of Pep, isn't there? I mean, I was thinking about this where, you know, you hear all these stories of Liverpool in the past where Ronnie Moran would say to the Liverpool players as they came in after collecting the league title, it's like, right, same again next season, put your medal away. You know, the Roy Keane, Alex Ferguson thing of right, on to the next one. And Guardiola has that. That's one of the reasons why he is such a good manager. But there was a certain showiness about that. There was a certain sort of, right, this is a guy that's had two authorised books about him. He's had an authorised Barcelona documentary about him. He's had the docu-series, the Amazon. Like, he is aware of his own place in football history. I was thinking about this, comparing it to, that was after they'd won the game. Do you remember when, we're all old enough to remember this. Remember when FA Cup finals were FA Cup finals, and it was Nottingham Forest against Tottenham Hotspur in 1991, mm-hmm. and it goes to extra time. And at extra time, managers are supposed to go out and tell their players what to do. And Brian Clough sat there and didn't do anything. And that was a point where we thought, we'll see some Clough magic, right? This is it. We're going to see what it is that makes Clough such a great manager. And he just sat back. Now, that might be to do with several things that were going on with Brian Clough's life. But it's, compare the Guardiola thing, which is this sort of very public, needless almost, gesture to Sterling, and the sort of Clough. You know, it seemed to me that this is a guy so aware of his public image, and Clough was someone that wanted to hide away what made him special, and put Guardiola... wants everyone to know how special he is.
But does that matter? I mean, he's so successful.
I mean, no one could. You mean the amount of trophies that he's won, and you know, you look at the comments that he made in the Monday's piece, which he spoke at after the press conference, and Jamie Jackson in today's paper, instantly setting sail on the Champions League, which is what winners do. Alex Ferguson did that after. So the game they showed the other day when Manchester United won the Cup Winners' Cup, he said, we need to win the league next season. And they would win the Premier League. We've got to win the Champions League. That's what winners do. But there is a, let's use the word, conceit about Guardiola. And it's deserved because he is such a great manager. But then, of course, as I'm sure we'll get to, he doesn't like being asked about himself too much.
Well, Rob Harris from APR for the game pressed him on a story from November from Der Spiegel, which alleged Roberto Mancini was secretly paid double his salary. Rob asked Pep if he'd been paid more or paid extra, and he said, are you accusing me? And said, oh my God, and you know, on this day of all days. What did you make of that set to?
I was very impressed with Rob. It took courage to ask that question. And I also respect Pep's right to be slightly insulted and outraged at being asked it straight after winning an FA Cup final. But it's the kind of question that, when is there ever a good time to ask it, you know, that's going to suit Pep? And it's a legitimate question. He could have just swatted it aside by saying, no, I haven't. But he chose not to do that for whatever reason, and got the right hump instead, as I suppose he's entitled to do.
I agree with Barry. I mean, I think it is. I mean, I can understand Pep's reaction to it. You know, he has just won a treble, which in the men's game is historic in English football. And there are questions, you know, being asked that are non-football in his eyes. I mean, you could argue that it, you know, it's all to do with football. But I mean, he would see that as, you know, as a completely different subject. But when will you get the opportunity to ask Pep Guardiola that question if it's not, you know, after or before an important football match?
Yeah, and Rob chose his moment well, because that's a press conference which is being filmed. I thought actually Pep's pout, which he did about midway through his cussing of Rob Harris, was mm-hmm. quite amazing. It's, if someone doesn't gift that up just yet, I'd be very, very surprised. But these are legitimate questions. These are questions that Manchester City as a club absolutely hate being asked, because they don't like having to answer them. Sometimes they might not have a straight answer to them, as was the case here. The question of their ownership is something that, if you are, I am told, within, one of their press days, that comes up, that is instantly shut down. They don't like those questions being asked. But the problem for them is, and someone equated to this, that point where Pep Guardiola had his head in his hands after the sixth goal, it did almost look like, well, I think we know what's coming, because what we might have forgotten is that we spent all week with their ownership being questioned. There was the UEFA stuff. There was also their response to the song on the plane. It hadn't been a great week for PR for Manchester City in any case. And then this question's asked. One of the purposes of the Abu Dhabi project was to publicise Abu Dhabi, give it this soft power. Now, questions are being asked of Abu Dhabi more than they would have been had they not owned what may well be the world's best football team.
And it's the same in PSG with the Qatari ownership there. They're finding exactly the same issues, where it was kind of bought as a popularity, and now the questions are being asked, and it's actually sort of turned on its head and making it more difficult. And there have been stories in France that maybe the Qatari group are looking to sort of calm down their influence maybe on Paris Saint-Germain.
You could argue that City are victims of how good they are as a team, because there's only so much you can write about how excellent they are on the field. So people are obviously going to look for other angles, different angles to write about. And, City have just won this unprecedented domestic treble. Their manager is angry. Their fans, I don't think, have ever been angrier.
Yeah.
And their owners appear to be quite angry as well. Mission unaccomplished.
David does say, can you give some time to Mo Salah and his performance in the FA Cup final? There was that City fan in the press box screaming about Mo Salah. I mean, obviously, he is not a representative of the normal Manchester City fan.
I wonder about that, having seen what's gone on in Twitter in the last week.
I don't think, I grew up with a lot of City fans, and not all of them are like that seething mass of rage that approached and was filmed by, well, Rob Harris, always on the scene. But, one of the problems with the Manchester City thing is, if you discuss the ownership, it's a big question if you're a Manchester City fan, because you turn around and you say, well, I don't care. Well, then you face the accusation of being ignorant about, say, human rights and homophobia and stuff like that. But then there is a lot of the Twitter stuff that Barry refers to is this sort of mobilisation, which is a support almost for what goes on in the Emirates. They're being apologetic for what goes on there. And that's quite amazing, really, because, it is only a football team. Mm. And there's such a loss of perspective goes on.
But social media, Twitter isn't a representation. Yeah. And I just wonder if anyone sympathises with, City fans who've supported this club for so long, who deserve some success because they haven't had any, and they use football as we use football as an escape, right? I'm just trying to say, if I was a City fan who was 50 years old and had been to Main Road and had watched just endless, terrible football, and now I've got success finally, and I'm not allowed to enjoy it because I have a conscience.
But what's more important, your conscience or the football team winning? Because, I don't buy this thing of, like, we suffered for so long. Manchester City was a middling football club. It wasn't the worst football club. I mean, Max, you support Cambridge United. Mm-hmm. Barry supports Sunderland. I was lucky enough to support a team that was very successful, now isn't. But I also have followed Macclesfield Town. That's about as low as it gets, But it's one of those things where, we suffered enough. Well, hang on, being a football fan is not really about, I need success now, and that's just the way it goes. But does your success come at the price of that?
But what do you do then if you're a City fan? Stop going, find another football team?
Well, I can't speak for Manchester City fans, but you have to accept that those criticisms will be there and make your own decisions off the back of that. And I understand, but there is this idea that people say, well, oh, I was born with it, my grandfather supported them, so I have to support them and all that. But you can support them and you can say, well, I don't agree with this. I don't agree with their stand on homosexuality. I don't agree with their stand on human rights. You know, the club across town, Manchester United, the one that they don't like being compared to, fans walked away because they didn't like the ownership. I'm not saying City fans will do that, but there is that possibility there.
Does their dominance matter? I mean, Wilson in the paper says football is broken, but Sean Ingle's written a good piece looking at some academics about since 2004, TV viewers certainly care less about whether games are close or unpredictable. They just want to see high-level players. Is it a case that football is just different now and it might not be what we like, but football changes, and I imagine for 40-year-olds in the 90s, if podcasts exist, we'd say, well, it's not like it used to be in the 70s.
I'll tell a family story here. My sister said to me that my nephew decided he liked Manchester City now after that game. Now, he's 7. I think he's 8 this week, in fact. And I said, well, that's not happening, you know. But the thing is, there is this idea, isn't there, that football supporting has changed. This idea that people follow individuals and it's a more global audience. But the one thing is to say is that, you know, we had a game like this, but that followed a week of playoff football, which are the closest, best games of the season, have been absolutely amazing. The quality of the football is nowhere as good as that Kevin De Bruyne brought onto the field or Raheem Sterling played.
And we've had a really amazing Champions League, right? The Champions League's been amazing, and the World Cup was brilliant, right?
City haven't won, you know. I thought Wilson's article was good. I thought it was a slightly hysterical. Maybe leave it another season just to see what happens. But yeah, it was a good article, but I didn't necessarily endorse it. But yeah, that I suppose it depends what you want from football, doesn't it? I like watching good games. I judge each game on its merits. If a game I'm watching is rubbish after 40 minutes, I'd probably give up on it unless it's important and I need to watch it for work-related reasons. And whether it's two non-league teams playing, two League Two sides, two women's team, whatever, you know, it's a game of football. I like football. If it's a decent game, I'll enjoy it. The team I support is in the third division. It doesn't really make any difference to me what's going on in the Premier League, and it doesn't really make any difference to me who wins the FA Cup, because there's a very, very good chance that it won't be my team. So, yeah, I suppose what I'm trying to say is it depends what you want from football.
I love watching Manchester City, and I don't mind. I mean, I don't want to see them batter teams 10-0 every week, but I don't mind watching them win games 5 and 6-0 when they put on the kind of... I didn't think they were absolutely amazing in that in the cup final, for instance, but there have been times this season, like when they beat Chelsea 6, and I happily watch that, for as long as it's pleasurable, and it, at the moment it is. When I see De Bruyne or Sane or Sterling, Aguero, whoever it is for City, I can still absolutely enjoy that, and then, you know, thrashing teams just like when Barcelona were at their absolute peak, that they were doing the same. Yeah, it doesn't need to be competitive for me to enjoy all the time.
It is slightly dispiriting though when you're watching an FA Cup final, this showpiece event, and the winning team's captain sort of grimaces with sympathy to his opposite number as the fifth goes in. The winning team's manager buries his head in his hands with embarrassment when the sixth goes in, and the losing team's players are all looking at the referee, imploring him to blow the final whistle so they don't, before they concede a seventh.
When I was at school, when we played rugby, James Swarbrick, because his voice had broken and he'd grown a foot, he wasn't allowed to score points after about 20 minutes. It sort of felt like that. We should talk about Vincent Kompany. I mean, brilliant career. Joined from Hamburg in 2008. Was named captain 3 years later. Third highest Premier League appearance record for City after Joe Hart and David Silva. He said, moving to Anderlecht is the most passionate yet rational decision he's made. He's going as a player manager. Interesting to see if he can combine the two. But what a brilliant footballer he's been, Mark. And also the fact that when people started to write him off, certainly at the, you know, a couple of years ago, he has been crucial, especially at the end of this season.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, in terms of dressing room character, I mean, he's much more than just a player to Manchester City. He arrived before the big money came in, and Mark Hughes signing, and he will go down as one of the greatest ever for Manchester City. And it's not just because of what he's done on the pitch, and I think that his influence there actually has been on the wane for a while, but just as a character, immense off the pitch as well. The stuff he does, you know, with the homeless in Manchester, and I think he's got very big plans of where he sees himself sort of, you know, in football. I'm surprised that he's taken the role of player manager at Anderlecht. I mean, it's difficult enough to do one of those two jobs, never mind do both of them. But he's already speaking about sort of trying to bring Pep's football to Anderlecht. You know, he's a very ambitious guy. And yeah, I think he's earned the right to kind of pick his next move whenever and wherever that was to be.
There are parallels, actually, and I wonder if across his mind there are parallels between what he's doing and what Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has done at Manchester United. You know, a revered club legend taking over at a club that is in disarray, and Anderlecht are in worse disarray than Manchester United were when Solskjaer took over. You know, they're under police investigation for money laundering in deals involving agents and transfers. The transfer of Aleksandar Mitrovic to Newcastle being one of them. They were fined in dock points earlier this season after crowd trouble resulted in a game against Standard Liège being abandoned. And they're probably not going to qualify for Europe for the first time in over half a century. So it's quite the shit show he's walking into there. And I just wonder if perhaps maybe across his mind he was looking at Solskjaer and going, you know, what if it all starts to go wrong for me?
You could also argue, though, that Anderlecht are probably at their lowest ebb in terms of that. You know, like you mentioned, no European football, way off the title race. And you know, how low can a team like Anderlecht go in Belgium? I'd suggest this is probably about as, you know, as bad as it can get. And, you know, you could be the person to kind of get that car moving in the right direction again.
I suppose Pep Guardiola's given him one thing, which is showed him how to answer questions about financial irregularities. Actually, just thinking about company, I had a theory. The goal he scored against Leicester.
Yeah.
Was that something a bit D-mob happy? Thinking, I'm out of here, so I may as well just do this.
Ah, sod it.
Yeah, I don't have to put up with this much longer, so I'm just going to give it some.
As you said on the radio yesterday, Barry, he should have just gone off there, shouldn't he?
He should have done the John Terry retirement thing, or, you know. What is it, John Terry went off in the 26th yeah. minute?
No, he should have just literally, after striking that ball, just taken his kit off, gone out the front.
Mic drop.
Yeah. Right down the, just straight to the airport. Off I go to Belgium. All right, that'll do for part one. In part two, we'll begin with the Women's Champions League final. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start with the Women's Champions League final. Lyon 4, Barcelona 1. Fourth Champions League title in succession for Lyon. The Guardian's women's football correspondent, Susie Rack, was there. Susie, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Very good, thanks. So now we've spent a lot of, well, the entirety of part one talking about the domination of Manchester City and how essentially it's not a good thing. You've written in your report yesterday, Lyon's one-sided mourning of Barcelona should be celebrated as a testament to investment and to equality. So this is good domination.
Yeah, it's a hard line to balance, isn't it? I mean, when you've got a team that is kind of thrashing other teams so comprehensively week in, week out, as Lyon do consistently in the league, it can look like it's a bad thing, but I mean, the reality is they have a budget that dwarfs every single women's team. They invest really heavily. I heard 15 million, which is beyond anything you can imagine, even here, Chelsea, Arsenal, City, etc. And they really, really integrate the team into the club. They're really considered a part of it. They flew straight back after the game to the Groupama Stadium in Lyon to celebrate with a massive party in the stadium. They're a vital part of the success of the club and the president's kind of plan for Brand Leon, and they are kind of very much treated equally with the men's players. Even the pay obviously is nowhere near the men's, but it's you know, 3, 4, 5 times what any other club can go near. So I think in their case, the kind of complete domination on the pitch, I mean, if you even looked at them lining up against Barcelona, they look physically fitter, stronger, bigger, muscular. They just look more like professional athletes, and it shows that the investment works. The investment can produce a product that is really, really good. And the only way that other kind of clubs are going to kind of start competing with them is if they start putting their money where their mouth is and kind of investing to the levels that they are.
Susie, how does sort of the rest of the women's game, though, say like Barcelona, how do they see Lyon? Are there any sort of question marks sort of from within the sport?
I think with a bit of jealousy more than anything. I don't think there's really question marks on what they're doing. I think most are now sort of aspiring to be there. And I think there's more a kind of sort of regard and respect that they've been doing it for as long as they have and have reached the height they have. The pressure is on them to consistently perform and prove that it's the investment that is doing the job. You watch them play. It's beautiful. It's beautiful, beautiful football. They're just really, really nice to watch, and it shows that what truly professional women athletes can be. Because for me, the reality with the so-called full-time Women's Super League, they're on a minimum 25-hour a week contracts. That's not full-time professionalism in any other workplace. But the FA can get away with calling it that in the Women's Super League. And the part-time second tier is minimum kind of, I think it's 8 or 16 hours a week, something like that. It's very low. Again, not what you would necessarily consider a part-time job in any other workplace. But they're getting away with it, and what Lyon shows is what you get if you do actually go full-time professional at every single level and kind of area of the club.
A hat-trick in 16 minutes from Ballon d'Or winner Ada Hegerberg, and 3 very well-taken goals, weren't they?
They were lovely. She's superb, and there were question marks over whether she should have won the Ballon d'Or, because you know, there's been some fantastic players particularly in Europe last year, Benel Harder being one, really, really exciting Danish midfielder. But you know, I think on Saturday night, Hegerberg shows just why she's so good. I mean, she's only 53 and she's got 44 Champions League goals, and the record is 51. So I mean, I think it's fairly predictable that she's likely going to smash that record. She's got well over 200 career goals already. She's just really, really great to watch. And it's very, very gutting that she's not going to be at the World Cup, but also massive respect to her for taking the step back that she has on principle.
Can you explain that step she's taken for people that don't know it?
Yeah, so she's kind of been in dispute with the Norwegian Football Federation since after the European Championships in 2017. She's never really liked the kind of seriousness with which the Federation has treated women's football in Norway, particularly at grassroots level and kind of in the kind of domestic competitions. The investment is low. You know, the various steps forward that have been made there, kind of the step towards equal pay for the national team, that didn't come from the federation. That was through the players' associations working with the men's team and stuff to come to those agreements. So she doesn't feel like you know, it's something she can wear the shirt of and play for with pride. Yet you see her at the Champions League final, and she's got the Norwegian flag round her. Like wrapped around her and is draping it up carefully on the field as they go up to collect the medals and stuff. You know, she's very, very proud of her country, but she's just won't play for the federation and give it the credibility and support that she would add because she doesn't like what they're doing for the women's game in the country, which it's hugely admirable, you know, think if any of the best players in the world in the men's game kind of said that they're not going to play on the biggest stage, it would hurt, it must be a really hard decision to make. You think of all the players that we didn't see play on the biggest stages, the likes of George Best, or, you know, if you're thinking of women's players, you know, you might never see Jess Fishlock at a World Cup, and it's Kim Little missed out on the Euros, she's going to the World Cup this time for Scotland. They're players that you want to see there, and she's choosing not to. So it must be an extremely difficult decision, but for me, hugely admirable.
Susie, thanks for your time.
No worries.
Susie Rack there, women's football correspondent at The Guardian. To the League One playoffs, Portsmouth 0, Sunderland 0. Sunderland threw 1-0 on aggregate, Barry. You must be dancing in the streets of Sunderland.
Yeah, very pleased. They've set up a sort of rematch of the Mendonca Mickey Gray 1998 Championship playoff final, one of the greatest games of all time, possibly the greatest playoff final of all time. And
because you didn't give them a hope of getting through this.
I wasn't confident. There's always a hope when you 1-0 up, but Portsmouth were poor in that second leg. Sunderland did what they needed to do. And yeah, they're through. It wasn't a very good game, to be honest. And I think Portsmouth will be very disappointed, you know, considering some of the playoff semi-finals we've seen. That was a fairly damn squib, and they probably didn't give a very good account of themselves. But hats off to Grant Ledbetter as well, who played the game and played well, despite losing his mum to cancer the day before. He didn't, you know, it was kind of low-key. It's sort of filtered out after the game that this happened, and kudos to him, because his family are diehard Sunderland fans. His dad's ashes are actually buried under the pitch at the Stadium of Light, or scattered on it. But so yeah, that must have been very tough for him, and it should make for an interesting final.
There was extraordinary footage of a Sunderland player falling into the crowd and
on neon,
and a Portsmouth fan basically kicking him, and then another Portsmouth fan just shouting, "Do you want some? You and me, let's go." I mean, really.
At Lee Cattermole.
Very,
and his, brave.
His eyes were just, I mean, it was sort of.
Do you know who he reminded me of? Do you remember that footage of the, do you remember when Arsenal won at Manchester?
Oh, yes. Yes.
At Old Trafford. And there's that guy, and he had sort of curtains hairstyle, and his eyes just bulged out of his head. Funny enough, I met that guy.
Yeah.
On a train once to Liverpool, strangely enough. And I turned to him and I said, "Are you that?" He said, "Yeah, that's me." Yeah.
But, I mean, hopefully they can obviously find out who those supporters are, given how...
I believe the guy who looked like something off the set of Deliverance and threw a couple of kicks into Nian was escorted off the premises shortly afterwards. And I suppose the other lad referred to by our friend Barca Jim as Weetabix head, he, you know, you're allowed shout at football games. He was aggressive. I don't think he did anything technically wrong. Wasn't racist abuse or anything. But part of me admires them, because I couldn't get that excited about anything, let alone, you know, somebody falling over an advertising hoarding or, you know, a football game.
It's just your natural reaction to not help someone up who's fallen over.
But no, I'll throw a couple of digs into them.
It's really bizarre. The other game was a cracker, wasn't it? Charlton 2, Doncaster 3, Charlton threw on penalties, Mark. Did you enjoy that one?
I did enjoy it. Not as much, though, as going through the agency photos in work yesterday, and there was a work colleague that popped up cuddling Lyle Taylor during the pitch invasion, so that was slightly embarrassing for him. But no, it was an absolutely great game of playoff football, sort of the very best of playoff action. Charlton had so many off-field problems, and Lee Bowyer returning to the club has just managed to connect the fans with the club once again, despite the ownership issues. Him and Johnny Jackson, he's number two, doing a brilliant job there to get them to the final. Also thought that Doncaster under Grant McCann, I'd seen Grant McCann managing Peterborough last season, and I thought he's got no chance. I mean, he was sacked, and rightly so. There was no kind of pattern of play to what they were doing. But the way that he's got Doncaster playing, I think punching above their sort of weight in terms of budget, and they were really unlucky not to go through. I felt for them at the end, and particularly John Marcus, who's been so brilliant for them for most of the season.
He's like a League One Andy Carroll, isn't he?
Yeah, and to miss, you know, the penalty like that. I mean, you know, somebody always, you know, has to go down as the villain of the piece. Him and Tommy Rowe were the two, but just a great game.
So Charlton v Sunderland is next Sunday. I look forward to spending the morning with you, Barry. You'll be a nervous wreck.
I'll be all right.
Your eyes will pop out when I don't know who's going to miss the penalty for you in the shootout.
Well, if it's a sort of rematch of. If it goes the way of the one in 1998, it'll be local lad who steps up because no one else will, and then misses with a pathetically feeble effort. So in the Mickey Gray role, I suspect it may be George Honeyman.
Do you think Clive Mendonca or Mickey Gray will get more work in the next week?
I'd imagine they'll both be as busy as they want to be.
I was going to say, have they found Clive Mendonca?
No, where is Clive Mendonca?
No, because, you know, I mean, he's not a regular media presence.
No.
Mickey Gray, as you two both know, is around and about, shall we say. But Clive Mendonca, this is, you know, has he appeared yet?
Clive Mendonca reflects on his Sunderland past and an awkward meeting with Mickey Gray. This is in the Sunderland Echo 2 hours ago.
Right,
so
okay.
Yeah, he has. Don't worry. Yeah. We have
found his number, yeah.
We have found Clive Mendonca. In the Championship, Tony Pulis has left Middlesbrough. Not a surprise for anyone. Started well this season and had sort of disastrously fell off a cliff and out of the playoffs. Jonathan Woodgate, the early favourite. He's a first-team coach at Borough. Danny Cowley of the Cowley brother's fame, presumably brings his brother with him. Chris Hughton, Nigel Clough also in the running, and Aitor Karanka wants it as well, which seems slightly odd. He was sacked in March 2017, the season after he got them promoted to the Premier League. Who would you take out of that lot? Mark, you put your hand up. How polite.
It's just I heard another name mentioned as well, which was Michael Reisiger, another former Borough defender. He's with Jong Ajax at the moment, the B team in the second division. They didn't have a particularly good season, but there's suggestions that, you know, Steve Gibson wants to kind of bring somebody in that can develop young players, and that, you know, would sort of lead you down the path, I suppose, of heading to Dutch football.
But haven't most of young Ajax's players been playing in the Champions League anyway?
Well, that's what I wondered, sort of how young the young Ajax ones
the
were.
Under sevens. Let's go to Fitbar Corner, Barry. Kilmarnock in Europe, Baz.
Kilmarnock in Europe, yeah. They beat Rangers 2-1 yesterday at Rugby Park to pip Aberdeen to third place in the league, which will earn them a spot in the first qualifying round of the Europa League, which
is next week.
Yeah. Starts next week, I'd imagine. Steve Clark is his final match in charge. He's expected to take the Scotland job at some point today, Monday. And yeah, after the game, he gave a sort of a valedictory speech in which he thanked Kilmarnock's fans. Their fan base has sort of multiplied in the couple of years he's been there. He's taken them from the doldrums right back into Europe. And I think it's the first time they've been in Europe for something nearly 20 years, 17 or 18 years, something like that. And he also had a dig at the travelling Rangers fans who were again subjecting him to sectarian abuse due to his past with Celtic. Celtic were presented with the trophy for winning the Premier League yesterday, and they're obviously qualified for the first qualifying round of the Champions League. They'll have to go to four rounds to get to make the group stages. The Daily Record today had sort of the difficult teams they could meet on their way. So in round one, it's Cluj from Romania, Their season actually will begin on the 9th of July. That's when the first round of qualifying for the Champions League is.
It's not fair, is it?
In the second round, if they get past the first round, it could meet Rosenborg or Maccabi Tel Aviv. The third round, Red Star, Apoel, Nicosia, and then the playoff, they could, you know, potential unseeded teams they could meet, Young Boys, Bate Borisov, Astana, Slavia Prague. These are all teams you could see giving Celtic a lot of trouble. Whether or not Neil Lennon is still in charge remains to be seen. And yeah, so that's the Scottish season ended. Dundee were relegated and St Mirren are now in a playoff with Dundee United to see who gets the last remaining sort of Scottish Premiership place. Will St Mirren keep their status or will Dundee United go up?
An email from Innes MacLeod. Hi. After Barry's anecdote about an Ian Rankin novel containing a plot point where a Newcastle United strip was mistaken for a Dunfermline Athletic top and how this may be seen as a slight to the Pars, the pod may be interested to know this may have been intentional. Rankin is a vocal supporter of local Fife rivals Raith Rovers. As a fellow Raith fan, hearing the woes of Dunfermline Athletic really cheered me up, so thanks for that. It was much needed considering Raith's almost more embarrassing feat of being the only fully professional team in Scottish League One and still somehow failing to win it. thank you, Innes. Greatly appreciated. Non-league finals day was yesterday. And the FA Vars, Chertsey Town, came from behind to win it. Two goals in extra time gave them a 3-1 victory over Cray Valley Paper Mills. Paper Mills is in brackets.
Kevin Lisby was playing for Cray Valley, wasn't he?
Mm. And was Boncho Gwenchev's son playing for Chertsey?
Absolutely, yeah. Now, I had a bit of a Wikipedia search of Kevin Lisby. I was trying to work out how old he is. He's 40.
Mm.
And as always with Wikipedia, it said something. Well, it said probably the best day, of probably the best game of his Charlton career was the hat-trick he scored against Liverpool. Now, he scored 17 goals in 155 appearances, so if that's probably... some of the rest of those goals must have been
pretty
good.
Special.
Yeah.
In the same day...
Oh, by the way, yeah. Actually, speaking of sort of old players, I saw Julian Gray, formerly of Crystal Palace, out walking his dog yesterday in Brixton.
You?
Yes,
that's
with
nice.
His, with Mrs. Gray.
Oh, lovely. FA Trophy was on the same day at Wembley. AFC Fylde 1, Leyton Orient 0. So some nice for Fylde after they'd lost in the playoffs to Salford. And Orient already won the league, so probably didn't mind that much. A lovely free kick from Danny Rowe, enough to overcome the O's. Mark, you look like poised to say something.
I just can't remember the last time Leyton Orient played. It feels like they've had sort of about a month off since they won the league, so maybe shouldn't be that surprised that they've come unstuck. But for Fylde, it must have been always great to play at Wembley, but it must have been difficult having, you know, such a non-event in the playoff final to then sort of have to get yourself back up for, you know, a big game, but you know, not the real main part of their season. So I mean, it's good that they managed to win something. I'm also a bit concerned about Julian Gray. I'm hoping it was Mrs. Gray with Julian. Otherwise, Barry could have some explaining to do.
Well, no, I think Julian will have some explaining to. I'm all right. He doesn't know who I am.
Filed when Salford City went up last week. Gary Neville made a big thing of talking about how helpful the owner of Fylde had been in guiding him through the whys and wherefores of non-league football. I mean, that's a guy. They've invested a lot of money there for that league, for a club that size. And Danny Rowe, actually, in the actual National League playoff, attempted that free kick about 15 times. I was watching that game. And the commentator says, oh, you know, there's no one better in non-league at the free kick than this guy. And every one of them was shanked somewhere into the North Circular. And then he got it right this time. So well done to him.
Well done, Danny. Right, that'll do for part two. We'll round up Europe in part three. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start in Germany with Archie Winter. Archie, how are you doing?
Very well, because I've watched Game of Thrones.
Stop! What happens? Does the big king of Mordor fall off his horse? How does it finish? I'm desperate to know. Does the dark Night King evaporate into the sea of death? Anyway, Archie.
Yes,
carry on.
I did this especially so that so that nobody off Twitter would ruin it for me as well.
Barry has taken his headphones off and has his hands covering his ears. Five of the nine games had six or goals or more in the Bundesliga. Proper final day that in the Bundesliga, wasn't it? And Bayern retained the title.
I mean, Wolfsburg 8, Augsburg 1.
Brilliant.
Nothing says final day like that. Not so good for West Ham fans that Reece Oxford was in the Augsburg defence there. But at the top end, yes, Bayern win the Bundesliga title again. Seventh Bundesliga title in a row for them, as expected. Same old, but it wasn't really, because I was at the Allianz Arena on Saturday and they were nervous. They went 1-0 up in the first half and they could have been 5 or 6 up had it not been for Frankfurt keeper Kevin Trapp. But it was a very emotional day because you had Arjen Robben and Franck Ribéry, two players who have shaped Bayern over the last decade and two greats of the world game, let alone in the Bundesliga as well. They were both on the bench. So Bayern went in at halftime 1-0 up, thanks to Kingsley Coman. And then, with Eintracht Frankfurt, who only last weekend were still in a Champions League spot, they equalised through Sebastian Haller. And suddenly, the arena was a little bit quiet, apart from this one corner. And with Borussia Dortmund, who, over in Mönchengladbach, they needed to win, and Bayern needed to lose for Dortmund to become champions. And for 150 seconds or so, it was quite nervous, apart from on the pitch with the Bayern players, because then David Alaba made it 2-1, and from there, Renato Sanchez made it 3. Then we had Franck Ribéry and Arjen Robben coming on, and that's when it got really emotional. And Bayern is a club who, for all those outside of it, it's very difficult to like. I have experienced that in Germany here with I cannot describe to you the tidal wave of hatred that there is for Bayern Munich for all those who are not Bayern Munich fans. But even for outsiders who I've spoken to, even they've got a little bit emotional when Franck Ribéry, first of all, scored. President Uli Hoeneß, who he's very close to indeed. Ribéry was the only player who went and visited Hoeneß whilst he was in prison, for example. Ribéry scored, took his shirt off, got a yellow card, hugged the referee, was all quite sweet. And then Arjen Robben, who was on 98 Bundesliga goals, he made it 5-1. So the title's all sewn up. And he actually had a really good chance for his 100th Bundesliga goal, missed out in the end. He said he was going to get a little bit of grief from his sons, Kai and Luca, because of that. But great day for Bayern Munich. And indeed, a very fitting end to their Bayern careers for Arjen Robben and Franck Ribéry. Still a lot of pressure, though, over Bayern coach Niko Kovac. A lot of talk that he may not make it, even if he wins the double with the DFB Cup against Leipzig next weekend, or this coming weekend.
A nice image of Ribéry sitting opposite Uli Hoeneß with the glass screen on the phones, chatting in prison. Philippe Auclair wrote on Twitter, you know, Frank Ribéry's just won a 9th German title, something nobody's ever achieved before him. He's so underrated, he probably wouldn't make the top 20 in a poll of this century's most underrated players. Do you think that's fair?
I think he is underrated, but that's only because of how much hype there is over Cristiano Ronaldo and Lionel Messi. And actually, I think in the year that Bayern won the Champions League in 2013, when Franck Ribéry's back heel set up Arjen Robben for the winner, which was played over and over again on the screen on Saturday afternoon, I think that went a little bit under the radar. And look, the consistency that Messi and Ronaldo have shown, I think, is remarkable. But what Ribéry has done is also quite something. I also have to say, I've never seen an entourage like Franck Ribéry's on Saturday. I counted 25 behind him, which included quite a few younger children as well, family and friends. But that was quite something. And
I don't think children count as an entourage, Archie. I'm not an expert in these things.
In this case, because they had the number 7 shaved into their heads as well.
Oh, really?
Very much Team Ribéry, so yeah.
Archie, can Dortmund come back stronger next year, do you think?
Yeah, for sure. Look, there's been a lot of chat about have they been choking, for example, at the end of this season because they were 9 points clear of Bayern and they were still celebrating, not so much, of course, as Bayern were on Saturday, but they could still celebrate what had been a really good season given the fact that they scraped into the Champions League places on the final day last season, and they have improved so much under Lucien Favre. A little bit of mentality has been lacking, but for what it would cost Favre in terms of changing his mentality and for him to adapt, I think that actually they'd need a different coach, and a different coach would not have been able to play the football that they have this season. So Jadon Sancho is going to stay. That Manchester United didn't get into the Champions League, I think, is a good thing. Because if Sancho was to leave Dortmund right now, for everything that he's got going for him, and who knows, next season may not be quite as good as this one. He ended up with 12 goals and 18 assists. And I think since they started including assists in Germany 30 years ago, no one has reached 30 scorer points, as they call it. So scorer points are when they add goals and assists together here.
So no one in Germany set anyone up for a goal until that time? Everyone just got the ball and just ran through like Georgie Kinkladze and scored. Bayern's win had implications further down the table. Eintracht Frankfurt miss out on the Champions League.
Yes, they did. I saw one of their press officers was in tears at the end of the game against Bayern, but that was actually tears of joy because such were results elsewhere where Mainz, who are Frankfurt's local rivals in the Bundesliga, and they beat them last weekend 2-0. Mainz ended up then doing them a favour this weekend because they came from 2-0 down to beat Hoffenheim 4-2, which meant Hoffenheim missed out on Europe. Werder Bremen also won against Leipzig, but they miss out on Europe despite having a very good season. So it means that Leverkusen take the final Champions League spot, Kai Havertz and a Lucas Alario hat-trick inspiring them to a 5-1 win away at Hertha Berlin. Kai Havertz, by the way, 19 and player of the season for me, outstanding talent. It's only a matter of time until he goes somewhere for 100 million or more. In the Europa League, you've got Gladbach, who were beaten by Dortmund, of course. Wolfsburg, who, as we mentioned, won 8-1 against Augsburg. And then Frankfurt, despite taking 2 points from the last 6 games, they're into the Europa League qualification, which means their season starts in July. They played 50 games this season, so they're going to have quite a few more. But just to say as well, we talk about how exciting this title race has been in the Bundesliga, how it's gone to the final day. The reason for that is not because of how good Bayern and Dortmund it has been. It's because of how good the rest of the league has become. And that is actually thanks to Pep Guardiola leaving. That certainly plays a role, in my opinion, because it's been much more watchable. The teams have grown in confidence. They get more of the ball. We have the most goals this season in the Bundesliga in 32 years. So, yeah, it helps not to have somebody dominating the league so much as the Pep Guardiola side does.
And there was final day drama at the top of the second division as well.
Yeah, very quickly, Paderborn are up into the Bundesliga. They've had quite a record over the last few years. 2014, they were promoted to the Bundesliga for the first time. 2015, they were relegated to the second division. Following season, 2016, relegated to the third division. Then relegated out to the fourth division, but given a reprieve because 1860 Munich didn't get their license. Following that, they then made the most of the reprieve, promoted back to the second division at the start of last season. And then this season, on the final day, they're promoted back to the Bundesliga on a minuscule budget. They could only afford for the second time this season to actually fly to the game in Dresden, where they lost 3-1, which meant that Union Berlin could have gone up into the Bundesliga for the first time. They were 2-0 down until the final 10 minutes away at Bochum, and then made the stunning late comeback, had a chance in the very last kick of stoppage time, which was saved, which means they go into the relegation playoff against Stuttgart, which is on Thursday. The first leg that in Stuttgart, and then the second leg in Berlin next Monday.
Cheers, Archie.
Cheers.
Archie went up there out in Germany. In Spain, Real Madrid lost again 2-0 at home to Real Betis. Zidane afterwards saying basically he was happy the season was finished. That was pretty much the only positive. And that he wouldn't have brought Gareth Bale on even if he'd been able to make 4 substitutions.
Did he actually say that though?
Yeah, that's been denied.
Oh, is that nonsense?
Yeah, there was a delegation of journalists. One guy came up with it, didn't he?
Yeah, I think it very badly sort of he'd said about, you know, there would have been this issue had I made another substitution, and then that was sort of then turned around to saying he'd said that Gareth Bale, you know, he wasn't going to get on even if he made a full sub. But obviously it leaves Gareth Bale in a terrible position. I think it's unfair the way that it's ended, actually. I mean, it's okay, I think, to want to get rid of Gareth Bale, but he's somebody that, as Sid mentioned on Twitter, you know, he's done a lot for Real Madrid in terms of Champions League finals, turning up in virtually all of them and playing important parts. To not be given, you know, any kind of send-off at the Bernabeu just felt wrong, really.
But it's also the fans are responsible for that as well. You know, they wouldn't have given him a send-off either. I mean, it's so strange that, I mean, they just haven't taken to him.
No,
at the end of that game, while his teammates were doing their lap of shame or whatever, he just turned around and walked down the tunnel on his own. It doesn't seem to be popular with his teammates or the fans or Zidane. And there are reports that he gave a radio interview saying that he told teammates, ironically, that he's apparently, you know, doesn't really talk to, that he'll sit out his contract by working on his golf game. But, you know, I'd imagine they'll come up with some payoff that's satisfactory to both parties and he'll move elsewhere.
His agent has been quite public about the fact that he wants to stay.
I interviewed him. It was a strange interview. It was a
Jonathan
while back.
Barnett,
yeah, it was a while back. It was when Jonathan Barnett came out and said the Real Madrid fans have treated him terribly. And I asked him, have you spoken to Gareth about this? And he went, no. I'm like, that seems very strange.
Yeah, I mean, I think him still being happy to stay, that's obvious hardball over money and making sure that wherever Gareth plays his football next season, that Real Madrid have to pay for that privilege. And you would have thought that should he come back to the Premier League, it will be on a loan. And that Real would be playing a significant proportion of his wages, and that's what's going on in that type of talk.
Where do you think he'll go?
Well, I imagine Ed Woodward probably thinks, you know, should we do, you know, but that would be probably the wrong place for him to go. But Manchester United would be the place that seems obvious in the Premier League. But if Real Madrid are paying, then it could be anywhere. You'd imagine the owners of even West Ham might think, you know, we could have Gareth Bale at Arte. But the problem is,
Bale wouldn't go there, right?
No, but I think, is that right, Mark? He's played in 40 games this season, so that there is this idea that he's injury prone, but this season that hasn't been the case.
There's a real PR machine sort of coming out of Madrid of just how terrible Gareth Bale is, in, you know, terrible fitness record. Wouldn't speak Spanish, doesn't integrate in the dressing room, is only interested in golf. Courtois said, you know, he didn't come out to dinner with us, he'd rather be in bed. And it just feels very odd, really, that it's come to this. I would imagine that Bale would see himself if it come to England, it would only be for a big six team. I mean, I do wonder if Chelsea are able to sort of get out of this transfer ban, whether a situation could arise, not in a swap deal with Hazard necessarily, but he's somebody senior that could come and play on that sort of left wing. Maybe that would make a little bit more sense than Manchester United, who have already got plenty of players
that position,
in that position.
Godin and Griezmann played their final games for Atletico as they came back to draw 2-2 at Levante. Valencia made it into the Champions League places, having been 15th in December. Great turnaround, but heartbreaking, Mark, for Getafe, because they were so close, weren't they?
They were. I think most people in Spain, sort of outside of those that believed in the fairy tale, would be delighted, because there was this suggestion that Getafe would kind of embarrass themselves in the Champions League. They've got a terrible tin pot stadium, don't play particularly great football, a couple of veterans in the team, and there was this sort of belief that Valencia would do kind of Spain proud in the Champions League. But I mean, it would have been fantastic. No budget whatsoever. To have even got so close was an amazing achievement. Valencia just managed to turn a load of those draws in the first half of the year into victories and probably did just about deserve it.
To Italy now. Max Allegri is off with that and the rest. Here's Paolo Bandini.
Well, it has been quite the eventful few days in Serie A. Since the last podcast, Juventus have announced their parting ways with Massimiliano Allegri. There was an emotional farewell press conference on Saturday where Allegri appeared with the club president, Andrea Agnelli, and both men said all the right things about knowing when the time had come to move on. But honestly, I thought that both just looked totally shell-shocked. And I feel like I could argue a case either way for whether or not this was a good move. Okay, so Allegri did win five consecutive Serie A titles. He won four doubles. I think he's an incredible manager, but this probably was his most disappointing season at the club. And despite the arrival of Ronaldo, you could argue that things have got a bit stale. So I understand that case. But what does seem bonkers to me is that Juventus have made the decision to fire him, apparently without even starting to line up a replacement first. So now we have stories linking them from everyone to Simone Inzaghi, to Mauricio Pochettino. The Lazio manager has done well. You know, he did just win the cup, but are you really going to hire a guy with zero Champions League experience for the maybe 2-year window you have of trying to win the thing with Ronaldo? But then again, do you have enough left over in your budget to go after a Poch figure who's going to cost far more given how much you're spending on Ronaldo? So that's obviously a huge story, but the stuff on the pitch this weekend that I think was even more compelling. Atalanta got a point away to Juventus, while Inter were thrashed 4-1 by Napoli on Sunday night, meaning that Atalanta are now up to third. But they're level on points with Inter. They're still only one ahead of Milan going into the final weekend, which means it's very much all to play for between those three. If Atalanta and Inter win, they're both in. But Inter are playing against an Empoli team that is fighting desperately against relegation. They've won their last three games, Empoli, and this weekend they beat Torino, who were fighting for Europe 4-1. Torino also had the joint second tightest defence in the whole division before that game. Atalanta, meanwhile, notionally at home to Sassuolo on the final weekend, but they're actually playing their home games at Sassuolo's home ground at the moment because their own stadium is undergoing redevelopment. So all of that is on a knife edge, and it's a similar story in the relegation scrap. Empoli moved out of the relegation zone with that win over Torino, which means that Genoa have now dropped in. But Genoa are playing Fiorentina on the final weekend, and Fiorentina haven't won a game since the 17th of February. In fact, incredibly, I mean, awfully, I think, Fiorentina can still get relegated themselves. They're on 40 points, but if they lose and have a couple of other results go against them, they're going to drop all the way below Genoa. So that such a thing as even possible is extraordinary given how well they were playing earlier this season, getting lauded for an abundance of young talent and ambitious passing style on Stefano Pioli. But they've just been in total freefall, and especially since bringing in Vincenzo Montella back as the manager last month. So that, again, on a knife edge, lots to play for on the final weekend. Safe to say it's going to be a fascinating final round to the Serie A season.
Thank you, Paolo. Mark, who's going to get the Juve job for you?
I think it's probably out of Antonio Conte and maybe Simone Inzaghi, the Lazio coach, who, you know, if Conte has already given his word to Inter and ends up there, maybe he could be parachuted in.
All right.
On the penultimate day of Liga, the top four all won, finalising their positions. Lille secured their entry into the group stages of the Champions League, while Lyon will start in the qualifiers. Saint-Etienne will take part in the Europa League. Monaco were the only team in the bottom half to win, barring an enormous turnaround. They're 3 points and 7 goals better off than Caen. They should be safe. Only thing of note to tie up next weekend is who will be relegated and who goes into the relegation playoffs. Monaco, Amiens, Caen and Dijon, the teams fighting for survival, as we all but know by now, Guingamp have gone. To Holland now, here's a question from Carl. He says, have you seen this? What would you and the rest of the pod do? It's from At The Sportsman. Dutch manager Henk de Jong currently finds himself in an interesting situation. He manages Eredivisie team De Graafschap, has to play first division team Cambuur in the promotion relegation playoff. Cambuur is the team he's going to manage next season. What do you do? What an ethical dilemma.
That is. What an impossible position to be in.
There was that similar situation, wasn't there, at the back end of the Italian season last year when De Vrij, the Lazio defender, made a horrendous howler that meant that his new team for next season, Inter, qualified for the Champions League at the expense of his old one, Lazio. So maybe there's a path for him to follow there.
Absolutely fudge it, obviously. In Poland, this is from At Sporting Life FC, Polish side Bytowia Bytow, apologies to our Polish listeners if I've got that wrong, had to win on the final day to have any chance of staying up. Their goalkeeper, Andrzej Wittan, scored a 97th-minute header. But another team, Suwalki, who are also battling the drop, scored in the 92nd minute to relegate Bytow despite that goal. I mean, he was so unmarked. You know how when a goalkeeper goes up for a corner, but the defence pay no attention? Literally everyone else is, it's man to man. It's brilliant defending, except the keeper's just stood there going, oh, I'm completely free. Speaking of goalkeepers, the A-League final, Sydney FC beat Perth Glory 4-1 on penalties after a goalless draw. Jonathan Hocroft writing in The Guardian, never mind 120 minutes, these two teams could have played 120 hours without scoring or even looking like breaking the deadlock. Adam Lafondra scored his penalty for Sydney FC. But Brenton Santelab's last act in professional football was to miss one of the penalties. Everyone has seen this, clearly, by the way you're laughing. Do you want to talk us through it?
What do they call those? A penenka?
Mm-hmm.
But essentially a back pass would be the description of it.
Penenka gone wrong.
Completely failed to give him the eyebrows.
Yeah, well, the keeper, Andrew Redmayne, just stood still. He did some dancing before. Looked much like a wiggle, popular kids entertainers from Australia. And then he just stood still and caught it. Apparently, this is from Adam Peacock of Fox Sports, Sydney goalkeeper coach John Crawley had notes on all the penalty takers. And next to Santelab, it simply said, dink, middle.
Somebody's got to do that to Ramos soon, surely. Yeah.
Well, did you say that was Sydney Wellington Phoenix?
Perth Glory.
Oh, Perth Glory.
Did I say Wellington Phoenix?
No. It was just that I've been to one A-League game. It was truly awful. And it was Sydney FC against Wellington Phoenix. And then I just thought, God, maybe they're still playing the game I went to in 2015.
I've only been to one A-League game. Melbourne Victory playing, I forget who against, that was also 0-0. Maybe there's never been a goal in the A-League. England play their Nations League semi-final against the Netherlands on the 6th of June, just 5 days after the Champions League final. There are 5 Spurs players, 3 Liverpool players in the squad. Harry Winks and Harry Kane, who are both not fit. We don't know how fit they are. We don't know what sort of cryo chamber they're both in.
Isn't the word that Harry Winks is back up and running now?
Winks was pictured on the Spurs sort of Instagram gallery in training.
Okay.
But I haven't seen any signs yet of Harry Kane. I don't know, hiding him.
He was apparently running in straight lines only.
Well, that's one way of playing, isn't it? I've seen a lot of Cambridge players not even do that. No Wan-Bissaka in the squads. No Luke Shaw. Nathan Redmond is in. Ruben Loftus-Cheek ruptured his Achilles in that charity game in the US. The final Whistle on Hate charity match against New England Revolution. 27 players' names. Gareth's got to cut it to 23 by May the 27th. He's also been talking about how worrying it is the number of English players playing in the Premier League. Only 30% of top flight starters during this season qualified to play for England. The top 6, only 20% were English. He says we've got to arrest the slide. I don't know how do you arrest the slide. He seems to say, look, there are good players developing, they're just not getting that opportunity. More transfer bans?
Well, for Chelsea that will work. And then you've got players like Jadon Sancho going abroad to find their fortune. And there is this sort of idea that European clubs, particularly in Germany, have realised that there is a generation of young English talent that can be harvested because they're not getting a game in English football's top level.
But then Maddison's played every week for Leicester and played very well, and you know, he's not been sort of promoted yet. I just think that you have to maybe then just look down to the Championship and say somebody like Jack Grealish, who runs the show every single time I watch Villa, he's just outstanding. I would happily have him in the team. I don't see Villa being any worse, say, than sort of probably the bottom six or seven. Six or seven in the Premier League. I mean, why not look at the top end of the Championship?
And I suppose one of the arguments is, and it's one put forward by Richard Scudamore over the years, so is that if only 15% of the players are really good, how does that compare to them being 35-40% of average players? You know, so the standard of English talent, I think, is pretty high at the moment.
Here's a tweet from Simon_Townley, hairdresser, owner of Townley UK. There's standing out and then there's outstanding, tick. Phil Jones, tick. When you're not a barber like the rest, you can create looks like this. Fire football.
I saw this early yesterday morning. Barry reacted to it later on Twitter. I saw what was that guy called? Blake Carrington appears to the sort of grey. Aguero's got that hairstyle. Mm. What colour is that?
I mean, is it silver? Is it grey or silver? What do you think?
I would imagine more fashion conscious people than us, but there's probably a technical term for
Matt Silver.
Yeah. Well, yeah. My main takeout from that was that Phil Jones appears to remove
his shirt
to yes, get a haircut.
He is topless.
I've never seen that before.
No, neither have I.
But I suppose
don't they just wrap the serviette around his neck and tuck it into the cape?
Maybe Phil Jones's club is so expensive that he can't afford to have dice spilled on it or something like that.
This is from Rajiv, who says, any chance the pod will do a pre-season tour of Asia? We listen to you every week in Hong Kong, unable to attend your live shows. I was in Hong Kong last week, and I met lots of people who really liked the pod, so I just sort of thought I'd say hello and thanks for listening to the pod in Hong Kong. I was at the Hong Kong seven-a-side, soccer sevens tournament, which I had no idea how big it was. A brilliant amateur club set up in 1885. Great old pictures on the wall, of which the absolute high point was meeting John Moss, the Premier League referee. And we saw him one evening, and him and Mrs. Moss were very nice, had a nice chat. The next evening, we said, where have you been all day? And he said, I've been out looking for Japanese vinyl because he's opening a vintage record shop called The Vinyl Whistle.
Is that true?
Absolutely, God's honest truth.
That's amazing.
And he was just...
You're into your vinyl, aren't you?
Yes, I am, yeah. Japanese vinyl tends to be quite expensive, the imports and stuff like that. So he's running one of those expensive shops, though.
Do you reckon?
Yeah, where you go in and you think, I would really like that record, but that cost £45 for an original pressing of The Fall or something like that.
Okay. Well, anyway, I mean, it blew my mind, but, you know...
Do you think he'll be like Jack Black in, what's that Nick Hornby film?
High Fidelity.
High Fidelity. So he'll sit behind the counter, and if you put your hand towards a record he thinks is bad, he'll just blow his whistle and hold up a yellow card or a red card.
That's one of the problems in going in these record shops is the disapproval of the people behind the counter.
When you say, have you got the Lighthouse Family?
Yeah. Yeah, got the latest Charles and Eddie. It's just
the thing about that trip is I knew Marcel Desailly was there. I knew he'd be cooler than me, but I really backed myself against John Moss and how wrong I was.
I bet Marcel Desailly's got some good vinyl as well.
Probably. Sam says, I've been on the Mark Langdon diet since moving to Japan. I've never felt or looked better. Massive fan of the no veg movement. If he wants a business partner to spread the message overseas, I'm your man. And Adam, to finish the pod, what veg would Mark Langdon rid of from the world forever?
Beetroot. Stinks and it spreads everywhere.
It stinks?
Oh, yeah.
Well, there we are. Barry, thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you, John.
Cheers, Max.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Max.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.